Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we are again for the 121st time on Capital Week. Welcome.
Good to be here, Dennis.
We have so much to discuss on this broadcast, as usual, including talks to try to avoid a debt default by the United States, Senator Grassley's efforts to try to overturn California's law that threatens to change the way Iowa produces pork, and more. But we start tonight with our Capital Week Caucus Almanac. Where's the theme for that? I don't think we have one. And word that Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is just about to officially jump into the presidential race, and Laura, he is going to be one of the jumbos.
Yes, and the timing is related to the fact that his campaign is apparently opening a separate headquarters. And once you spend a certain amount of money for the campaign under the Federal Election Commission rules, you have to officially declare as a candidate within a certain number of days after that. So that is influencing the timing, in case anyone is wondering why a candidate would make a big announcement right before a holiday weekend. But yes, he's raised a lot of money. The super PAC that's supporting him is expected to have tens of millions of dollars, and he is going to be probably spending quite a lot of time in the early states.
Every national poll shows that he and Trump, Donald Trump, are the two leaders in the race for the Republican nomination.
Yes, and he's pretty far behind. I mean, in most of the national polls I've seen, Trump has widened his lead in the last few months, but the DeSantis camp is hoping that they can do well in the early states. They supposedly have polling, internal polling from the early states that shows that there are a lot of Republicans who are ready to consider an alternative to Donald Trump, and they're hoping that they can get some momentum in Iowa and then use that the way, similar to how other candidates like Barack Obama, for example, turned a win in the Iowa caucuses into momentum in other states where they had been trailing the front runner.
Trump and DeSantis have already been to Iowa, of course, and they will come back, as will other candidates. In fact, one of them, Asa Hutchinson, the former governor of Arkansas, came back last week.
Yes, and he is trying to carve out, as we've discussed before, of all of the candidates, I think he has got the most unique niche because he is the most critical of Donald Trump, although in this most recent appearance, I don't think he discussed Donald Trump by name. But he did say that you don't have to be the loudest voice in the room. And sometimes I think we make a mistake listening to the loudest person in the room. And I think everybody in the room would know who he is referring to when he talks about the loudest person in the room.
Former GOP Vice President Mike Pence, Donald Trump's vice president, has not officially announced as of this Monday evening, but he will, and he's coming to Iowa tomorrow, Tuesday, and again on Wednesday.
Yes, he's doing some events in the Des Moines area. Then he's going to go down in Ottumwa in southeast Iowa. And I always have to laugh when I see Ottumwa on a Republican candidate's itinerary, because for many decades, Ottumwa was one of the strongest Democratic vote-producing areas in the state. It was a heavily unionized Democratic area, and now that part of the state has really flipped, and communities like Ottumwa, working-class areas, have flipped, and the county, Wapello County, which contains Ottumwa, gave more than 60% of its vote to Donald Trump in 2020, and that would have been something that in previous generations, people just wouldn't have believed. So when I saw that Mike Pence was going down to Ottumwa, I thought, wow, well, actually, there are a lot of Republican votes down there nowadays.
And there is this thing called the Roast and Ride that Senator Joni Ernst puts on every year, and she's going to do it on June 3rd at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines. And she has, so far, as of this Monday evening, put together quite a list of Republican candidates and would-be candidates who are going to be there with her.
Yes, it's right now, I believe we're up to 7, according to Senator Ernst. Joni Ernst, a political Twitter feed. She periodically is announcing new candidates or prospective candidates confirmed. And she says she's invited everybody. She's trying not to play favorites. I don't think it's very likely that she will endorse anybody before the caucuses. But it's basically everybody who might be a candidate other than Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. So we have Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina and UN ambassador in the Trump administration. We have former Vice President Mike Pence, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, businessman Perry Johnson, also businessman Vivek Ramaswamy, and the talk show host Larry Elder. And did I forget anybody? I think that, oh, and Asa Hutchinson, that's the seventh. So that it's going to be a full itinerary that day, lots of speeches. And this is an event that Joni Ernst has been hosting since 2015. And she usually gets a really good turnout there.
We've talked about this before on this broadcast. You mentioned those seven people, some of whom are not known at all across the country. Some of them are fairly widely known. It's hard to see, and we're looking at this objectively as journalists here, how any of these seven have a path to the nomination for president on the Republican side. It's just difficult to see.
Yes, because Donald Trump is a prohibitive favorite and front runner right now. So I think the path for any of these people would be that something would have to happen that would cause Donald Trump's candidacy to self-destruct in some way. And then Ron DeSantis somehow could underperform. I mean, Ron DeSantis is probably going to have as much money to spend as I think all of those other seven candidates combined. Probably he's really going to spend a lot of money. Also, his super PAC, the Never Back Down super PAC, as I mentioned, may have access to more than $100 million to spend. And they are already, there was a good report by the Associated Press reporter Tom Beaumont over the weekend that the Never Back Down PAC is already building a pretty large network of paid canvassers, and they're trying to build up a huge organizing network. So it's just going to be a difficult path for any of these other candidates to break through and get a significant number of people to show up on a Monday evening and mark their Iowa caucus paper for them.
Yeah, and we should mention very briefly that Tim Scott, the South Carolina senator, he officially announced he is running today.
Okay, that's right. He is running. And see, that's, in some ways, I've seen some speculation that this could make Iowa and New Hampshire even more important, because now you have two candidates from South Carolina, Nikki Haley, the former governor, and Tim Scott, the senator. And so they both have a very strong base of support down there. Of course, Donald Trump would have a strong base of support in South Carolina as well. So it's going to be really difficult for any other candidate to get any oxygen in South Carolina. So that means that you got to break through in Iowa or New Hampshire. There may be candidates such as prospective candidates, such as the current governor of New Hampshire, the former governor of New Jersey, might run. And if they do run, they'll be probably focusing on the New Hampshire primary more than the Iowa caucuses. But it just, it means that it's very important to break through. And I don't know how you do that when somebody like the former president is in the field, already has completely 100% name ID and a very strong base of support.
We have talked about this next topic before, but the Des Moines Register made a big deal about it last week, reporting that a complicated calendar fight could mean the date of next year's Iowa caucuses may not be firmly set for months. We know the Democrats are in a mess, and the Republicans are trying to tell the Democrats how to do their thing. Right now, is it fair to call this whole thing, just to summarize it, it's a mess?
It's a big mess. It was a good report by Brian Fahnenstiel in the Register. And the Republican Party is looking at a date in January. They have a few problems. First of all, depending on what happens with the Iowa Democratic caucuses, Iowa Democrats are still saying that they may have some sort of mail-in option, although they haven't said that the results of the presidential selection would be announced on caucus night. So it may still be that the Iowa Democrats are able to finesse this in a way that doesn't get New Hampshire antsy. But the New Hampshire Secretary of State feels that anything like a mail-in vote or presidential preference is too much like a primary, and that could cause New Hampshire to leapfrog ahead of the Iowa caucuses. And that's something Iowa Republicans would prefer to avoid, but may not be able to avoid. I wanted to mention one thing that I don't think was mentioned in the Des Moines Register article, that the chair of the Republican Party of Iowa, Jeff Kaufman, said that they're looking at a date in mid-January. Well, if you look at the calendar for January 2024, the middle of January is the 15th, and that happens to be Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And this, I was speaking recently with John Deese, who has helped organize the caucuses for the Johnson County Democrats for several cycles. And he said, this is going to be a real nightmare for the Iowa Democratic Party if that happens, because Iowa Democrats have already said, We're going to do our caucus on the same day as Republicans. Republicans don't care about scheduling a caucus opposite MLK Day because they don't have a very significant number of caucus goers who are Black. However, the Iowa caucuses one time in 2004 were held on MLK Day. There was a lot of blowback within the party. A lot of people were unhappy because they had to choose between going to their caucus or going to a community MLK event. And that's something the Iowa Democratic Party would really like to avoid, if possible, a January 15th, 2024 Iowa caucus date.
Laura, you're absolutely right. Nobody else has reported that. And that is why people need to listen to this broadcast right here, live on Monday nights. That was good reporting on your part. All right. Speaking of good reporting, we're up to the moment on the national debt ceiling talks as of Monday night anyway. President Biden resumed his negotiations with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy this Monday afternoon. They have now adjourned it for the evening. They are racing against time to try to avoid a debt default. They have excluded everybody else. It's just McCarthy and Biden. I don't know. What do you think, Laura? Can McCarthy keep his people in line and somehow strike a deal here?
I think that that's a really open question. I mean, President Biden has said that there are certain things he's not going to agree to, right? He's not going to agree to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act or the American Rescue Plan provisions or any major accomplishment from the last 2 years. And so he might be willing to negotiate on some things, clawing back the unspent COVID money and possibly some permitting of projects. But the question is whether Kevin McCarthy could get a majority in the House. I mean, he literally had no votes to spare when they passed their debt ceiling plan, their budget proposal, which is a non-starter for Democrats and the president. So I just don't know whether President Biden would make a deal that Kevin McCarthy could accept. And I also don't know whether if the House Speaker did accept the deal, whether he could get the votes for it. I mean, right now, Iowa's Republican delegation, I've been keeping an eye on their social media feeds, and they're periodically just posting statements that you would expect criticizing the president for supposedly not giving enough ground and supporting what Kevin McCarthy is trying to do. But it looks like we could be headed to a really difficult economic situation. And I should say that a lot of people have said that June 1st is the deadline. We don't really know that the United States would go into default on June 1st. That's a date that the Treasury Secretary has said. I mean, it's possible that the time could come later in June, and a lot of other options. I've seen other options discussed that President Biden could invoke the 14th Amendment and say, no, we're just going to keep spending and we're not going to worry about the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling is unconstitutional, and see what happens. But I mean, this would be something that could destabilize not just the U.S. economy, but the entire global economy.
Yeah, if this looks like a giant game of chicken, it really is. The problem is the stock market, according to some, could go into the tank. Medicare and Social Security payments could be halted. How quickly, we don't know, but that's all on the table.
Well, it is. And I think that the federal government, I mean, they would prioritize. I was listening to a discussion. Josh Marshall of Talking Points Memo was talking about how, because we have had a couple of government shutdowns in the last 10 years, there is almost a procedure that the federal government, they could, I mean, certain things would close, right? National parks and certain non-essential things would close. Probably, I would say Medicare and Social Security would be things that the federal government would try to protect and continue to keep funding for as long as possible. But I think that's where, like I said, the 14th Amendment language comes in, that the president and his administration may just try to prioritize certain spending, but that can't last forever. I mean, that's something that could maybe keep things going for a few weeks. But again, and the markets, people might say, well, why do I care what happens with the U.S. Treasury bonds or something if they go into the tank? But a lot of things in the economy are pegged to the interest rate on U.S. Treasury bonds, for instance. And so it could end up really affecting a lot of people who don't think that they're maybe invested in the stock market or bond market, but then it could just affect everyday things like your borrowing costs for an everyday mortgage or small business loan.
It is 14 minutes and 18 seconds after the hour. How's that for an exact time cue? You are listening to KHOI's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart. That was an exact time cue. Your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We're here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capital. what it all means. It's now 14 minutes and 40 seconds after the hour, wherever you are. All right, here's something Zach Nunn probably doesn't have a problem with. Russia added him to their sanctions, their personal sanctions list last week. Third District Congressman Zach Nunn, he's probably smiling about that.
Oh, he is. He was bragging about it on his Twitter feed. So this is something that happens periodically when the United States, or in this case, the G8 nations announced new sanctions or tightened sanctions on Russia, that Russia, the Russian Federation retaliates by announcing another list of people who are personally sanctioned and won't be allowed to enter the country. So last year, a year ago in April, Russia sanctioned about 400 members of Congress, including all of Iowa's U.S. House members. A few weeks after that, they sanctioned a bunch of senators, including Joni Ernst. And later in the year, they sanctioned even more senators, including Chuck Grassley. But Zach Nunn, of course, wasn't in Congress last year. So now there was a list of 500 people that the Russian Federation released on Friday. I looked through it to see the Iowa names. I didn't find any Iowa names other than Zach Nunn, but there were several dozen members of Congress, mostly new members who weren't serving there last year. And Zach Nunn has been supportive of Ukraine. He's done some work in Ukraine. He was an election monitor during the 2019 elections, an international election, I should say, during the 2019 election in Ukraine. And so he said that he was proud to be sanctioned by Putin's regime.
And indeed, he probably has a lot to be proud of. All right. Congratulations, Zach Nunn. All right. U.S. House members voted last week to keep George Santos. Oh, my. This is the man, as everybody knows, if you've been following news at all for the last few months, who lied about virtually everything on his resume. And it was up to a vote last week on whether to expel him. And no, said Iowa House members.
Yes, well, this was something I read recently in a national poll that George Santos has unusually high name recognition for somebody who's a new member of Congress. I mean, most people aren't that familiar with Congress other than the person who represents themselves, their own district. But George Santos has been the focus of so much news coverage, the butt of many late night comedian jokes. And I said, if the Republican majority in the U.S. House were larger, I think he would have been gone already. The leadership would have leaned on him to resign. But they have a big problem because they only have a 5-seat majority and they rely on George Santos. They could not have gotten that debt ceiling plan through without his vote. He literally provided the decisive vote that put it over the top. So the Democrats used a parliamentary maneuver to try to force a vote on a motion to expel him. It would have required a 2-thirds yes vote to expel him. Of course, that wasn't going to happen. And the whole goal of it was to put Republicans on the spot to force them to vote against expelling George Santos. So what the Republican caucus did is they voted to refer that motion to the House Ethics Committee for an investigation. Congressional reporters say the House Ethics Committee typically takes more than a year to conduct its investigations. And in a case like this, they would probably wait for federal prosecutors to complete all of their cases before they would embark on anything. So really what we're looking at is it's very likely that George Santos will be able to continue to serve until if something major happened with his criminal case or the next election, essentially, because the House Ethics Committee is very unlikely to take any action recommending his expulsion before the 2024 election.
All right, let's move from George Santos to pork, specifically California pork, not congressional pork. Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley working, he says, on legislation to overturn California's Prop 12. That's that animal welfare cruelty law upheld recently by the U.S. Supreme Court involving the way pork is made in Iowa. Chuck Grassley coming to the rescue, maybe, who knows, of pork.
Well, the Iowa delegation was very upset about that U.S. Supreme Court ruling that dismissed the pork producers' lawsuit against the California's Prop 12. And they made a lot of noise about it. And Chuck Grassley, he has long been active in representing agricultural interests. And so he said he was going to reintroduce this bill. I don't see it going anywhere. I mean, it didn't go anywhere in the last Senate, which was Democratic controlled. And I don't really see it going anywhere in this Senate. But it would be something that basically says that states can't regulate the agricultural practices of other states. And I mean, it probably just not going to get any traction at all in the Senate. But I've continued to see of critical comments from Iowa politicians, but they tend to direct their criticism at the California electorate, or usually in the terms I've heard, California liberals, rather than directing their anger at the U.S. Supreme Court justices who tossed that lawsuit.
Right. All right, let's talk about Congress again, another topic here. The GOP PAC, a GOP PAC, endorsed last week Ashley Hinson and Marietta Miller Meeks for 2024 battleground seats. This group is called Winning for Women. What was the import of this endorsement, if you will?
Well, this PAC has backed both Marionette Miller Meeks and Ashley Hinson before. I thought it was interesting that they labeled these battleground seats. The Democrats, as we discussed a few weeks ago, the Democratic campaign arm, which is called the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, they identified about 30 or so seats that they're going to play for, one of them being Iowa's first district, Marionette Miller Meeks, and another one being the third district, Zach Nunn. But they actually did not target Ashley Hinson's second district as a battleground seat. But the Winning for Women PAC apparently does consider it still a battleground seat. And so that will be, it's usually these endorsements. I mean, it's helpful for fundraising. It helps candidates access a national network of donors. This Winning for Women probably has a fairly sizable donor list and email a blast list. But right now, I mean, there are no Democratic challengers declared, to my knowledge, in any of the four districts of Iowa. So it's hard to see that these incumbents would be seriously threatened until we see what kind of person is going to run against them and whether that candidate can put together a well-funded campaign.
And now there's a story that you broke last week. It's breaking down the earmarks that Iowans in Congress have requested. And this is very interesting because three of our congressional members, three of our four, requested earmarks that are going to be passed out one way or the other, but one did not.
That's right. Randy Feenstra, this is for the third year in a row now. He is not participating in the earmark process. He says that Congress needs to spend less money. But the issue here is that the Congress sets aside, the Appropriations Committee sets aside a certain amount of money. I believe it's less than 1% of the total federal budget that can be set aside for earmarks. And so they decide what earmarks, how much they're going to spend on earmarks in the various appropriations bill, transportation, defense, agriculture, and so on, rural development. And so if you don't put in for your district, all that means is that your district just can't compete for any of those projects. It doesn't really mean that less money is going to be spent. I don't want to go through and describe in detail all of the projects, but I will just say, generally speaking, that Zach Nunn and Ashley Hinson really spread around their earmark requests, not a lot about some traditional agriculture, roads, bridges, airports, water infrastructure, but also some things related to healthcare, childcare, education. Ashley Hinson actually requested some public safety earmark to create a holding center or a jail on the Meskwaki settlement in Tama County. I thought that was interesting. And Marionette Miller Meek's earmark requests were really much more focused on traditional roads and water, wastewater treatment plants, and a few things in education. And I think she may have had one healthcare, but really just focused on the roads that you think of when you think of Congress earmarking funds for some infrastructure project. That's what you think about. Ashley Hinson, I should say, she does serve on the Appropriations Committee. So I'm going to be following up later this year to see which earmark requests get funded. And I'm curious to see whether she has a better chance of getting her request funded just by virtue of serving on the Appropriations Committee.
So again, to put a finer point on it, even though Mr. Feenstra has been consistent in not asking for earmarks, the truth of the matter is that money is going to be allocated and his district will get none of it.
That's right. The counties in the 4th District, they may still get some federal spending on other infrastructure projects. For instance, the broadband, there is some money for airports and bridges and so on that might come out of other bills that would go into the counties that are in the 4th District. But in terms of the earmarked funds, the ones that are assigned to specific projects that members of Congress request, all of the counties Randy Feenster represents, they have no chance at any of that money. And so when you look at these projects, I mean, it can be, some of these can be very impactful if they get funded. There's no guarantee that they're all going to get funded. But this is a lot of, like I said, water, infrastructure, airport work, things that communities would have a hard time funding, community colleges, state university programs. And so all of those things, I'm sure that there are recipients in the 4th District who would like to have a chance to compete for some of those projects.
All right, let's move on to the governor. Normally, we would not comment on the bills that Governor Reynolds has signed into law unless they're very, very big. We've talked about that. We don't talk about most of them. But last week, she signed a couple that deserve some mention. One is the fentanyl bill. This is something big around the country. Fentanyl has become known as a killer of people. And she signed a law where Iowa is going to impose stronger sentences for making, delivering, or possessing fentanyl.
Yes, and this is something that also Attorney General Brenna Byrd has talked about a lot, that this is going to be a priority. Her office is going to be getting some extra resources for criminal prosecutions, and I think this is one area that they want to focus on. Iowa, as have many states, Iowa has seen an increase in overdose deaths. Quite a few of those are related to fentanyl. A lot of times people may buy painkillers that they don't realize are laced with fentanyl, and just even taking a single pill can be fatal. So this is something that I heard. I mean, almost everybody in the legislature supported this bill. There were a few Democrats who voted against it on the grounds that they thought it would exacerbate racial disparities in the system, and they thought it wasn't a very balanced approach, looking at also prevention and addiction treatment and so on. But almost everybody supported increasing these criminal penalties. But again, this bill is addressing one side of the issue, the law enforcement issue, and it's not what I would call a comprehensive strategy on fentanyl or on addiction generally.
And she signed into law another bill that had near unanimous support. And this one will make more Iowa families eligible for child care assistance.
Yes, according to the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, they reckon that families with about 2,600 children will become eligible for Iowa's child care assistance. And it will allow a slightly higher income for people who qualify. It's also, on the flip side, it's going to require more work. Instead of 28 hours a week, I think 32 hours a week of work to qualify for state child care assistance. And sometimes that can be tricky because a large percentage of Iowans, especially in rural Iowa, live in places that are known as child care deserts, places where there just aren't a lot of child care providers. And if people don't have someone, an extended family member, for instance, who's able to watch the kids, a lot of people, they just can't put in those work hours because they literally can't find someone for any price. They can't find somebody to watch their kids. And that's something that everybody recognizes contributes to the workforce shortage that many politicians talk about here.
And we have about 2 minutes left. One more note here. We've talked about that child labor legislation that was passed that would let 16 and 17-year-olds sell and serve alcohol in Iowa. But word came down last week that some feds say the child labor law does not comply with federal law.
Yes, this was a letter that the Iowa Senate Democrats released last week. So Senator Nate Bolton had written to the U.S. Department of Labor asking about some of the provisions in this child labor bill and whether they were consistent with the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. And the letter came back and it said that it identified several potential areas of problems, mostly in what the bill does to relax work regulations for 14 and 15-year-olds, that it allows 14 and 15-year-olds to work longer shifts than federal law allows. It allows them to work in somewhat different occupations and activities. It allows them to work shifts that go later in the evening. And so Nate Bolton has said this is going to cause a real problem with employers because now they're getting a mixed message. They're going to be hearing from the state, you're allowed to do this, that, and the other. But that some of those things can put them in violation of federal law. So it's something that I expect that we are going to hear a lot of Democrats continue to talk about this I don't think the governor has signed this bill yet, but she is expected to sign it. And this is something that Democrats are probably going to continue to talk about.
We have about a minute left, and we should tell you that Laura and I will not be here next week live because we're going to take Memorial Day off the weekend, but a lot of things are going to still be happening. What do you expect to be following in the next week or two while we're off the air, Laura?
Well, before a holiday weekend, I always look for what they call a pre-holiday news dump, and it whether the governor is going to sign some unpopular measures on that Friday before Memorial Day, whether she'll make some other announcement that she doesn't want to get a lot of news coverage. So I'm always very closely watching things on the Friday afternoon before Memorial Day. But I just want to tell everybody, stay safe. I hope everybody has an enjoyable weekend.
And I hope you have an enjoyable weekend with your family and with Sammy the dog.
Yes, we will. The weather's been nice for long walks with Sammy the dog.
You bet. We're out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be taking next Monday off. Yes, we will, for Memorial Day. But we will be back live the following Monday, June 5th. And we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics, Iowa style. As always, we hope you can join us. Thanks for the privilege of your time. We hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week and a meaningful Memorial Day.